also to have lost faith in the seen one. Consider this poll, taken in 2002 for the first anniversary of September 11th. 61% of Americans said they were optimistic about the future, as opposed to 43% of Canadians, 42% of Britons, 29% of the French, 23% of Russians, and 15% of Germans. I wouldn't reckon those numbers will get any cheerier over the years. What's the most laughable article published in a major American newspaper in the last decade? A strong contender would be a column published in the New York Times in July 2005 by the august Princeton economist Paul Krugman. The headline is French Family Values, and the thesis is that, while parochial American conservatives drone on about family values, the Europeans live it, enacting policies that are more family-friendly. On the continent, claims Professor Krugman, government regulations actually allow people to make a desirable trade-off, to modestly lower income in return for more time with friends and family. How can an economist make that claim without noticing that the upshot of all these family-friendly policies is that nobody has any families? Isn't the first test of a pro-family regime its impact on families? As for all that extra time, what happened? Europeans work fewer hours than Americans. They don't have to pay for their own health care. They don't go to church, and they don't contribute to other civic groups. They don't marry, and they don't have kids to take to school and basketball and the 4-H stand at the county fair. So what do they do with all the time? Forget for the moment Europe's lack of world-beating companies. They regard capitalism red in tooth and claw as an Anglo-American fetish, and they mostly despise it. And in fairness, some of their quasi-state corporations are very pleasant. I'd much rather fly Air France than United or Continental. But what about the things the Europeans supposedly value? With so much free time, where is the great European art? Assuredly, Gershwin and Bernstein aren't Bach and Mozart, but what have the Continentals got? Their pop culture is more American than it's ever been. 50 years ago, before European welfarism had them in its vice-like death grip, the French had better pop songs, and the Italians made better movies. Where are Europe's men of science? At American universities. Meanwhile, continental governments pour fortunes into prestigious white elephants of Euro-identity, like the Airbus 380, the QE2 of the skies, capable of carrying 500, 800, 1,000 passengers at a time. If only somebody somewhere would order the damn thing, which they might consider doing once all the airports have built new runways to handle it. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure it's a swell idea. It'll come in very useful for large-scale evacuation operations, circa 2015. When life becomes an extended picnic with nothing of importance to do, writes Charles Murray in Our Hands, ideas of greatness become an irritant. Such is the nature of the Europe syndrome. The continent has embraced a spiritual death long before the demographic one. In those 17 European countries that have fallen into lowest low fertility, where are the children? In a way, you're looking at them. The guy sipping espresso at a sidewalk cafe, listening to his iPod. The eternal adolescent charges of the paternalistic state. The government makes the grown-up decisions, and we spend our pocket money on our record collection. Hilaire Belloc, incidentally, foresaw this very clearly in his book The Servile State in 1912, before record collections, or even teenagers, had been invented. He understood that the long-term cost of welfare is the infantilization of the population. The populations of wealthy democratic societies expect to have total choice over their satellite TV packages, yet think it's perfectly normal to allow the state to make all the choices in respect of their health care. It's a curious inversion of citizenship to demand control over peripheral leisure activities, but to contract out the big life-changing stuff to the government. And it's hard to come up with a wake-up call for a society as dedicated as latter-day Europe to the belief that life is about sleeping in. Famine. In 2005, responding to Islamist terrorism in Britain and elsewhere, Germany was reported to be considering the introduction of a Muslim public holiday. As Matthias Döpfner, chief executive of the media group Axel Springer, put it, a substantial fraction of Germany's government, and if the polls are to be believed, the German people, believe that creating an official state Muslim holiday will somehow spare us from the wrath of fanatical Islamists. Great. At least the appeasers of the 1930s did it on their own time. But in recasting appeasement as yet another paid day off, the new proposal cunningly manages to combine the worst instincts of the old Europe and the new. If you want the state of the continent in a nutshell, consider this news item from the south of France, 2005. A fellow in Marseille was charged with fraud because he lived with the dead body of his mother for 5 years in order to continue receiving her pension of 700 euros a month. She was 94 when she croaked, so she'd presumably been enjoying the old government check for a good 3 decades or so, but her son figured he might as well keep the money rolling in until her second century, and, with her corpse tucked away under a pile of rubbish in the living room, the female telephone voice he put on for the benefit of the social services office was apparently convincing enough. As the Reuters headline put it, Frenchman lived with dead mother to keep pension. That's the perfect summation of Europe. Welfare addiction over demographic reality. Think of the European Union as that flat in Marseille, and the utopian political consensus as the stiff, and lavish government largesse as that French guy's dead mom's benefits. Take the one-time economic powerhouse of the continent, Germany, and pick any of the usual indicators of a healthy, advanced industrial democracy. Unemployment? The highest since the 1930s. House prices? Down. New car registration? Nearly 15% lower in 2005 than in 1999. General nuttiness? A third of Germans under 30 think the United States government was responsible for the terrorist attacks of September 11th. While the unemployment, real estate, and car sales may be reversible, that last number suggests the German electorate isn't necessarily the group you'd want to pitch a rational argument to, especially about the urgent need to either give up the unsustainable welfare state or to produce a population capable of sustaining it, whether by immigration, transhuman science, or the old-fashioned method of a box of chocolates, the lights down low, and Johnny Mathis on the hi-fi. Here's another statistic. 30% of German women are now childless. Among German university graduates, it's over 40%. Yet according to polls taken before the inconclusive 2005 German elections, 70% of people want no further cuts in the welfare state and prefer increasing taxation on the very rich, whoever he is. And only 45% of Germans agreed that competition is good for economic growth and employment. It seems things are going to have to get a lot worse before European voters will seriously consider necessary reforms and painful changes. And the longer European countries postpone the painful reforms, the more painful they're going to be. Almost every issue facing the European Union, from immigration rates to crippling state pension liabilities, has at its heart the same root cause, a huge lack of babies. Every day you get ever more poignant glimpses of the Euro future, such as it is. One can talk airily about being flushed down the toilet of history, but even that's easier said than done. In eastern Germany, rural communities are dying, and one consequence is that village sewer systems are having a tough time adjusting to the lack of use. Populations have fallen so dramatically that there are too few people flushing to keep the flow of waste moving. Traditionally, government infrastructure expenditure arises from increased demand. In this case, the sewer lines are having to be narrowed at great cost in order to cope with dramatically decreased demand. There's no precedent for managed decline in societies as advanced as Europe's, but the early indications are that it's going to be expensive. One notes again that the environmentalists got it exactly backward. It's not a question of sustainable growth, but of sustainable lack of growth. And no advanced society has attempted that experiment till now. For purposes of comparison, by 2050, public pensions expenditures are expected to be 6.5% of GDP in the United States, 16.9% in Germany, 17.3% in Spain, and 24.8% in Greece. In Europe, we're talking not about the prospect of having to reduce benefits, but about so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, adieu, 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 to you and you and you. American reformers like to say that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. The EU has a vastly greater problem. The entire modern European edifice is a Ponzi scheme. And the political establishments in Paris, Berlin, Brussels, et al. Show no sign of producing leaders willing to confront it. Germany has a shrinking economy, a shrinking and aging population, and potentially catastrophic welfare liabilities. Yet the average German worker now puts in 22% fewer hours per year than his American counterpart, and no politician who wishes to remain electorally viable would suggest closing the gap. The Dutch and the Norwegians are even bigger slackers. This isn't a deep-rooted cultural difference between the old world and the new. It dates back all the way to, the 1970s. It's a product of the U.S. military presence, a security guarantee that liberated European budgets. Instead of having to spend money on guns, they could concentrate on butter and buttering up the voters. But even with reduced defense expenditure, the European welfare state depends on economic growth and population growth. The former is now barely detectable, and the latter is already in reverse. After the rejection of the European Constitution, Jacques Chirac reacted to his impertinent electorate's appalling lèse majesté by appointing as French Prime Minister a man who was the very embodiment of the ruling elite's serene insulation from popular opinion, Dominique de Villepin, the magnificently obstructionist, big-haired foreign minister in the run-up to the Iraq War. Aside from his Byronic locks, Monsieur de Villepin also writes sub-sub-sub-Byronic doggerel. Whenever he turns up on CNN, starry-eyed Democrat viewers send cooing emails to Wolf Blitzer and Jack Cafferty, wondering why their own vulgar republic can't produce a political leader who speaks English with such suave erudition. A veritable Rambo. To Bush's Rambo. So, in his first big speech in the gig, Monsieur Sophisticate was at pains to reassure French voters that the internal tensions of a pampered, lethargic, overregulated welfare society could all be resolved through Gallic genius. In a modern democracy, the debate is not between the liberal and the social. It is between immobilism and action. Solidarity and initiative, protection and daring. That is the French genius. Ooh la la, c'est magnifique, c'est formidable, n'est-ce pas? All those elegant nouns just waiting for a stylishly coiffed French genius to steer the appropriate course between the Scylla of solidarity and the Charybdis of initiative, between protection and daring, immobilism and action, inertia and panic, stylish insouciance and meaningless gestures, abstract nouns and street riots, etc., etc. The French electorate has relatively down-to-earth concerns— crime, jobs, immigration. But for a man of letters, that's all too dreary and prosaic compared with an open-ended debate between solidarity and initiative, stretching lazily into the future. Across half a century, continental politics evolved to the point where almost any issue worth talking about was ruled beyond the bounds of polite society. Austria was the classic example. Year in, year out, whether you voted for the center-left party or the center-right party, you wound up with the same center-left, center-right coalition presiding over what was, in essence, a two-party, one-party state. In France, Monsieur Chirac isn't really center-right, so much as ever so slightly left of right of left of center. And even that distinction only applies when he's standing next to his former prime minister, the right of left of center, Lionel Jospin. Though supposedly from opposite ends of the political spectrum, in the 2002 presidential election, they wound up running against each other on identical platforms, both passionately committed to high taxes, high unemployment, and high crime. Americans often make the same criticism of their own system, the Republicrats, etc., but the United States still has a more genuinely responsive politics, with more ideological diversity than anywhere in Western Europe. On the continent, the Euro-D and Euro-Dumb mainstream parties are boxed into a consensus politics that's no longer viable. The people are weary of certain aspects of this post-war settlement, permanent double-digit unemployment, and the Islamization of their cities. But they're not yet ready to give up the social programs, the short work weeks, long vacations, and jobs for life. Europe's structural problems would require immense cultural change to correct. Is it likely that Europe will muster the will for painful economic reforms? It was always a political project masquerading as an economic one, and thus the ruling class's investment in it is largely emotive and ideological. Hence the Guardian's attack on the British Prime Minister for demanding reform of the common agricultural policy. It is unreasonable of Mr. Blair to repeatedly flourish, as if self-evidently outrageous, the simple arithmetic of 40% of spending on 4% of the European workforce, when rural life is of such social, psychological, and aesthetic importance to a vastly larger proportion of the continent's population. I think aesthetic importance means we have to drive past a lot of French farms to get to our holiday homes. Rural life was central to France's sense of itself, but so was the Catholic Church, and it's empty now, and so were Catholic-sized families, and they're down to one designer kid. So the character of those quaint villages is utterly changed. Why should the British taxpayer subsidize an ersatz French heritage park, about as authentic as Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame? If Pierre's given up the church and the family, what's the big deal about giving up the farm? Ah, well, it won't be a problem much longer. Under its present economic arrangements, it's Europe that's bought the farm. War. According to its Office du Tourisme, the big event in Evreux, the first weekend of November 2005, was supposed to be the annual Fête de la Pomme, du Cidre et du Fromage at the Place de la Mairie. Instead, in this charmingly smoldering cathedral town in Normandy, a shopping mall, a post office, two schools, upwards of 50 vehicles, and, oh yes, the police station, were destroyed by, what's that word again? Youths. Over at the Place de la Mairie, Monsieur le Maire himself, Jean-Louis Debray, seemed affronted by the very idea that en soupçon de carnage should be allowed to distract from the cheese tasting. 100 people have smashed everything and strewn desolation, he told reporters. Well, they don't form part of our universe. Maybe not, but unfortunately, you form part of theirs. Monsieur Debray, a close pal of President Chirac's, was a little off on the numbers. There were an estimated 200 youths rampaging through Evreux with baseball bats, They injured, among others, a dozen firemen. To those responsible for the violence, I want to say, be serious, Monsieur Debray told France Info Radio. If you want to live in a fairer, more fraternal society, this is not how to go about it. Oh dear, who's not being serious here? In Normandy, it's not just the cheese that's soft and runny. Granted that France's overregulated economy severely obstructs the social mobility of Muslim immigrants, even Monsieur Debray cannot be so out of touch as to think seriously that the rioters were rioting for a fairer, more fraternal society. But maybe he does. The political class and the media seem to serve as mutual reinforcers of their own obsolete illusions. In December 2002, I was asked to take part in a symposium on Europe and began with the observation that I find it easier to be optimistic about the futures of Iraq and Pakistan than, say, Holland or Denmark. At the time, this was taken by the left as confirmation of my descent into insanity. Europe was still regarded as a bastion of progress. By 2006, the right was querying the thesis, arguing that the Bush Doctrine is a crock. How can liberty save the Muslim world when Muslims are jeopardizing liberty in Europe? Well, they're not contradictory positions. In the Middle East, it may well be that, as the gnarled old Yankees tell tourists, you can't get there from here. But I'd argue there's a sporting chance of being able to get at least partway there from the here and now of the present Muslim world. Whatever their problems, most Islamic countries will be embarking on their evolution into free states as reasonably homogeneous societies. European nations face the trickier job of retaining their freedoms at a time of increasing societal incoherence. They're getting there from here in the one-way express lane, and they're not going to like where they end up. About 6 months after September 11th, I went on a grand tour of the continent's Muslim ghettos and then flew on to the Middle East. The Muslims I met in Europe were, almost to a man, more alienated and angrier than the ones back in Araby. Don't take my word for it. It was a Hamburg cell that pulled off September 11th, a British subject who was the shoe bomber, a London School of Economics graduate who had Daniel Pearl executed. True, America and Australia grew the institutions of their democracy with relatively homogeneous populations and then evolved into successful multicultural societies. But the continent isn't multicultural so much as bicultural. You have hitherto homogeneous Scandinavian societies whose cities have become 40% Muslim in the space of a generation. Imagine colonial New England when it was still the Mayflower crowd, and one day they woke up and noticed that all the Aldens and Standishes, Cooks and Winslows, were in their 50s and 60s, and all the young guys were called Ahmed and Mohammed. That's what happened in Rotterdam and Malmö. There are aging native populations and young Muslim populations, and that's it. Two solitudes, as they say in my beloved Quebec. If there's three, four, or more cultures, you can all hold hands and sing, "We are the world." But if there's just two, you and the other, that's generally more fractious. Bicultural societies are among the least stable in the world, especially once it's no longer quite clear who's the majority and who's the minority, a situation that most of Europe is fast approaching, as you can see by visiting any French, Austrian, Belgian, or Dutch maternity ward. Take Fiji, not a comparison France would be flattered by, although until the late 1980s, the Fijians enjoyed a century of peaceful, stable, constitutional evolution the French were never able to manage. At any rate, Fiji is comprised of native Fijians and ethnic Indians brought in as indentured workers by the British. If memory serves, 46.2% are native Fijians, and 48.6% are Indo-Fijians. 50-50, give or take, with no intermarrying. In 1987, the first Indian-majority government came to power. A month later, Colonel Sitavini Rabuka, officer of the Order of the British Empire, staged the first of his two coups. Is it that difficult to sketch a similar situation for France? Even in relatively peaceful bicultural societies, politics becomes tribal, loyalists versus nationalists in Northern Ireland, separatists versus federalists in Quebec. Picture a French election circa 2020. The Islamic Republican Coalition wins the most seats in the National Assembly. The Chirac East crowd gives a fatalistic shrug, and Monsieur de Villepin starts including crowd-pleasing surahs from the Quran at his poetry recitals. But would Jean-Marie Le Pen, or by then his daughter, take it so well? Or would the temptation to be France's Colonel Rabuka prove too much? And the Fijian scenario, a succession of bloodless coups, is the optimistic one, and not just when measured against such notable bicultural societies as Rwanda. After all, the differences between Fijian natives and Indians are nothing compared to those between the French and les Beurs. All those Bush Doctrine naysayers who argue that Iraq is an artificial entity that can never be a functioning state ought to take a look at the Netherlands. You think Kurds and Arabs, Sunni and Shia, are incompatible? What do you call a jurisdiction split between post-Christian, secular, gay potheads and anti-whoring, anti-sodomite, anti-everything-you-dig Islamists? If Kurdistan's an awkward fit in Iraq, how well does Pornistan fit in the Islamic Republic of Holland? Europe's problems don't nullify the Bush Doctrine so much as present a more urgent case for it. As to the French youth, a gentleman in Antibes cautioned me against characterizing the disaffected as Islamist and advised me to examine them more closely. They look like L.A. gangsters, he said, not beturbaned profit monkeys. Leaving aside more than a few cries of Allahu Akbar on the streets, my friend is correct. But that's the point. The theoretical virtue of multiculturalism is that it's a form of mellifluous cultural cross-pollination, the best of all worlds. But just as often, it gives us the worst of all worlds, the worst attributes of Muslim culture, the subjugation of women, combined with the worst attributes of Western culture, license and self-gratification. Tattooed, pierced Pakistani skinhead gangs swaggering down the streets of Northern England are as much a product of multiculturalism as the turban-wearing Sikh Mountie in the Royal Escort. Islamofascism itself is what it says, a fusion of Islamic identity with old-school European totalitarianism. But whether it's turbans or gangster threads, just as communism was in its day, so Islam is today's identity of choice for the world's disaffected. In 2001, Paris elected its first openly homosexual mayor, Bertrand Delanoë. And, as always, this was taken as evidence of how cool and relaxed everyone is about the whole gay thing nowadays. Monsieur le Maire certainly worked hard to put the gay in gay Paris, potted palms and parasols along the Seine all summer long, etc. His big idea was the Nuit Blanche, the sleepless night, of October 5th, 2002, when the city's landmarks would be open for one big all-night party. Come to the Louvre, the Arc de Triomphe, the Eiffel Tower, and if you make it through till dawn, there'll be free coffee and croissant. City Hall itself was done up like a stylish tween wars nightclub, and no state security metal detectors on the doors, because, after all, what genuine jazz boite would have such things? And that's where Monsieur Delanoë was, in the thick of the festive throng, when he got stabbed. His assailant missed his aorta by less than an inch, but gamely the mayor insisted that the party go on, while he was taken to the Pitié-Salpêtrière hospital for a 3-hour operation that saved his life. His would-be killer was a Muslim immigrant, Azdin Berkan. But, as the establishment was at pains to emphasize, the good news is that he wasn't a terrorist. No, he's just a Muslim who hates homosexuals. And that's good news how, exactly? Le Monde reported from Monsieur Berkan's wretched riot-prone ghetto the views of his neighbors. "He was a bit like us," said one. "We're all homophobic here because it's not natural." "It's against Islam," said another. "Muslim fags don't exist." A traditional terrorist has demands which are in most cases subject to circumstances. He doesn't want your troops on his soil? Okay, we don't really need them there anyway. But a Muslim who hates you just 'cause? That's all but impervious to external pressure. The old joke about British Palestine was that it was the twice-promised land. Hence today, a Western democracy and a disaffected Muslim population exist in, for the most part, two solitudes on the same piece of real estate. But doesn't that sum up Europe, too? The jihadists understand that the continent is up for grabs in a way that America isn't. And as their numbers grow, it seems likely that wily Islamic leaders in the Middle East will embrace the cause of the rights of European Muslims, in the same way that they claim solidarity with the Palestinians. When France began contemplating its headscarf ban in schools, it dispatched government ministers to seek the advice of Egyptian imams, implicitly accepting the view of Islamic scholars that the Fifth Republic is now an outlying province of the Dar al-Islam. As the Zionist entity can testify, that's not a club you necessarily want to be signed up for, though it helps explain why the Quai d'Orsay can live with Iran becoming the second Muslim nuclear power. As things stand, France is on course to be the third. And what happens when, say, Iran starts spreading a little terror startup money through France and the Netherlands, the way the Ayatollahs have done in Lebanon and Gaza? What would it take to persuade a European Muslim to blow himself up in an Amsterdam gay bar? Few EU leaders have a clue what to do about this, but as France's headscarf law and Britain's incitement to racial hatred bill underline, mediation between what Tony Blair called, in the wake of the tube bombing, our way of life, and Muslim values, has already become a central dynamic of European political culture. A remarkable achievement for a minority few Europeans were more than vaguely conscious of before September 11th. Meanwhile, across the borders pour not primarily suicide bombers or suitcase nukes, though they will come in the end, but ideology, fierce, glamorous, and implacable. Here's the final irony, and perhaps the most distressing of all to European anti-Semites. In one of history's better jests, in this scenario, they're the Jews. Conquest. As The Guardian reported in London in 2005, French youths fired at police and burned over 300 cars last night as towns around Paris experienced their worst night of violence in a week of urban unrest. Ah, those French youths. You mean Pierre and Jacques and Marcel and Alphonse? Granted that most of the youths are technically citizens of the French Republic, it doesn't take much time in les banlieues of Paris to discover that the rioters do not think of their primary identity as French and likely never will. 4 years after September 11th, it turned out there really is an explosive Arab street. But it's in Clichy-sous-Bois. Since the beginning of this century, French Muslims have been carrying on a low-level intifada against synagogues, kosher butchers, Jewish schools, etc. The concern of the political class has been to prevent the spread of these attacks to targets of more, general interest. They're losing that battle. Unlike America's Europhiles, France's Arab Street correctly identified Chirac's opposition to the Iraq War for what it was, a sign of weakness. The French have been here before, of course. 7:32. Not 7:32 Paris time, which is when the nightly Citroën torching begins in the burbs, but 7:32 A.D., as in 1 1/3 millennia ago. By then, the Muslims had advanced 1,000 miles north of Gibraltar to control Spain and southern France up to the banks of the Loire. In October 7:32, the Moorish general Abdulrahman and his Muslim army were not exactly at the gates of Paris, but they were within 200 miles, just south of the great Frankish shrine of Saint-Martin of Tours. Somewhere on the road between Poitiers and Tours, they met a Frankish force, and, unlike other Christian armies in Europe, this one held its ground, like a wall, a firm glacial mass, as the Chronicle of Isidore puts it. A week later, Abdulrahman was dead, the Muslims were heading south, and the French general, Charles, had earned himself the surname Martel, the Hammer. Poitiers was the high water point of the Muslim tide in Western Europe. It was an opportunistic raid by the Moors, but if they'd won, they'd have found it hard to resist pushing on to Paris, to the Rhine, and beyond. Perhaps, wrote Edward Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the interpretation of the Quran would now be taught in the schools of Oxford, and her pulpits might demonstrate to a circumcised people the sanctity and truth of the revelation of Muhammad. There would be no Christian Europe. The Anglo-Celts who settled North America would have been Muslim. Poitiers, said Gibbon, was an encounter which would change the history of the whole world. Battles are very straightforward. Side A wins, side B loses. But Europe is way beyond anything so clarifying. Today, a fearless Muslim advance has penetrated far deeper into Europe than Abdulrahman. They're in Brussels, where Belgian police officers are advised not to be seen drinking coffee in public during Ramadan. And in Malmö, where Swedish ambulance drivers will not go without police escort. It's way too late to rerun the Battle of Poitiers. When Martine Aubry, the mayor of Lille, daughter of former Prime Minister and EU bigwig Jacques Delors, and likely presidential candidate in the post-Chirac era, held a meeting with an imam in Roubaix, the gentleman demanded that it take place on the edge of the neighborhood, in recognition that his turf was Muslim territory, which she was bound not to enter. Madame Aubry conceded the point, as more and more politicians will in the years ahead. The peoples of Europe may not be willing to go as far down the appeasement path as their rulers, but Europe is a top-down construct, so the rulers will get quite a long way down before the masses start to drag them back. One observes, for example, that brave figures who draw attention to these trends, men and women such as Theo van Gogh, Bat Yeor, and Oriana Fallaci, are either murdered, forced to live under armed guard, driven into exile overseas, or sued under specious hate crimes laws. Dismissed by the European establishment, they're banished to the fringe. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the Somali-born Dutch parliamentarian, spoke out against the ill-treatment of Muslim women, a subject she knows about firsthand, and found herself under threat of death. Her neighbors, the justice system, and the Dutch government reacted to this by taking her to court, getting her evicted from her home, and announcing plans to revoke her citizenship. Boundlessly tolerant Europe, which finds it so hard to expel openly treasonous, jihad-inciting imams, finally found one Muslim it's willing to kick out. Meanwhile, the complacents hold down prestigious chairs at European universities and think tanks, and assure us there's no problem. Timothy Garton Ash is an Oxford professor who directs its European Studies Center, the sort of chap National Public Radio calls in when they need an expert on the EU. Very reasonable fellow, so reasonable that in 2003 he was attacking yours truly in every leading European newspaper for promoting anti-Europeanism in the United States. Yet, after scoffing at my Euro predictions for many years, he seems to have accepted them. The only difference between us is that he thinks it's a good thing. The populations of Europe are aging fast, so more immigrants will be needed to support the pensioners, and these will largely be Muslim immigrants. For this increasingly Muslim Europe to define itself against Islam would be ridiculous and suicidal. Let's imagine for a moment Europe in 2025 at its possible best, a political, economic, and security community of some 40 free countries and 650 million people, embracing all the lands in which the two world wars began, and producing still a large part of the wealth of the world. A further 650 million people born in the most explosive parts of the early 21st century globe, but now living in a great arc of partnership with this European Union, from Marrakesh via Cairo, Jerusalem, Baghdad, and Tbilisi, all the way to Vladivostok. That would not be nothing. No, indeed, it would certainly be something, but quite what, he declines to say. And that's what Garton Ash sees as the continent's possible best, a giant Euro-Muslim arc of partnership. Faced with a choice between correcting course or drifting irrevocably into Eurabia, Garton Ash has chosen consciously to embrace the latter. He will not be the last. And so those continental demographic trends will accelerate, as they did during the decline of the Roman Empire, when the imperial capital's population fell at one point as low as 500. Some French natives will figure they don't have the stomach for the fight and opt for retirement elsewhere. The ones who don't will increasingly be drawn down the old road to the neo-nationalist strongmen, promising to solve the problem. That's why I call it the Eurabian Civil War. The de Villepin-Chiraciste tendency will be to accommodate and capitulate. But an unreconstructed minority will not be so obliging and will eventually act. Meanwhile, it will be the Muslims who develop a pan-European identity, if only because many have no particular attachment to France or Belgium or Denmark, and they'll quickly grasp that cross-border parties and lobby groups will further enhance their status. The European Union's already the walking dead, but the Eurabian Union might well be a runner. If Chirac, de Villepin and company aren't exactly Charles Martel, the rioters aren't doing a bad impression of the Muslim armies of 13 centuries ago. They're seizing their opportunities, testing the foe, probing his weak spots. If burning the Berbs gets you more respect, they'll burn them again and again. In defiance of traditional immigration patterns, these young men are less assimilated than their grandparents. And why should they be? On present demographic trends, it will be for ethnic Europeans to assimilate with them. In City Journal, Theodore Dalrymple concluded a piece on British suicide bombers with this grim summation of the new Europe. The sweet dream of universal cultural compatibility has been replaced by the nightmare of permanent conflict. Which sounds an awful lot like a new Dark Ages, or the future implicit in Cardinal Ratzinger's choice of name for his papacy, Benedict XVI. Born in Umbria in 480, St. Benedict was the man who ensured during the Dark Ages that the critical elements of Roman and Greek civilization were preserved, and that, by infusing them with Christianity, they would emerge in a new and stronger form, the basis for Europe and Western civilization. Referring to his namesake, Pope Benedict XVI once quoted a Benedictine motto, Succisa viracit, pruned, it grows again. That may prove true for Christianity. It's a growing faith in Africa and China, and could yet be so again in Europe. Whether there will be any Spaniards or Italians left to re-enlist is more questionable. In the course of the 21st century, Germany's population will fall by over 50% to some 38 million or lower, killed not by disease or war, but by the utopia to which the German people are wedded. And every time they're asked to vote on the issue, they decide that, like that Frenchman, they can live with the stench of death as long as the state benefits keep coming. The trouble with the social democratic state is that when government does too much, nobody else does much of anything. After September 11th, I wondered rhetorically, midway through a column, what we in the West are prepared to die for, and got a convoluted email back from a French professor explaining that the fact that Europeans weren't prepared to die for anything was the best evidence of their superiority. They were building a post-historical utopia, a Europe it would not be necessary to die for. But sometimes you die anyway. Part 3. The New Dark Ages and How to Lighten Up. Chapter 7. The State of the Art Primitive. The Known Unknowns versus the Knowingly Unknowing. Pale Ebenezer thought it wrong to fight, but Roaring Bill, who killed him, thought it right. Hilaire Belloc, The Pacifist, 1938. Every so often, I find myself, for the umpteenth time, driving behind a Vermont granola mobile, whose bumper not only proclaims the driver's enduring post-2004 support for Carrie Edwards, but also bears the slogan, Free Tibet. It must be great to be the guy with the printing contract for the Free Tibet stickers. Not so good to be the guy back in Tibet, wondering when the freeing thereof will actually get underway. Are you in favor of a free Tibet? It's hard to find anyone who isn't. Every college in America is. There's the Indiana University, students for a free Tibet, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, students for a free Tibet, and the Students for a Free Tibet University of Michigan chapter, and the University of Montana, students for a free Tibet in Missoula, which is where they might as well relocate the last three Tibetans by the time it is freed. Everyone's for a free Tibet, but no one's for freeing Tibet. So Tibet will stay unfree, as unfree now as it was when the first Free Tibet campaigner slapped the very first Free Tibet sticker onto the back of his Edsel. Idealism as inertia is the hallmark of the movement. Well, not entirely inert. It must be a pain in the neck when you trade in the Volvo for a Subaru and have to bend down and paste on a new Free Tibet sticker. For a while, my otherwise not terribly political wife got extremely irritated by the Free Tibet shtick, demanding to know at a pancake breakfast at the local church what precisely some harmless, hippy-dippy old neighbor of ours meant by the sticker he'd been proudly displaying decade in, decade out. "But what exactly are you doing to Free Tibet?" she insisted. "You're not doing anything, are you?" "Give the guy a break," I said when we got back home. "He's advertising his moral superiority, not calling for action. If Rumsfeld were to say, 'Free Tibet? Jiminy, what a swell idea. The 3rd Infantry Division goes in on Thursday,' the bumper sticker crowd would be aghast. They'd have to bend down and peel off the Free Tibet stickers and replace them with, 'War is not the answer.'" But there'll never be a Free Tibet, because through all the decades Americans were driving around with the bumper stickers, the Chinese were moving populations, torturing Tibetans, imposing intermarriage, until Tibet was altered beyond recognition. By the time the guys with the Free Tibet stickers get around to freeing Tibet, there'll be no Tibet left to free. That's stability. As President Reagan liked to say, status quo is Latin for the mess we're in. When Amr Moussa, Secretary General of the Arab League, warns, as he did before the Iraq War, that America is threatening the whole stability of the Middle East, it's important to remember that stability is Arabic for the mess we're in. Yet just as the environmentalists believe in ongoing dramatic climate change, so the foreign policy establishment believes equally in ongoing, undramatic, geopolitical non-change. And just as there's minimal evidence for climate change, so there's minimal evidence for stability. The geopolitical scene is never stable. It's always dynamic. If the Western world decides in 2005 that it can contain President Psy Kotick of Wakistan indefinitely, that doesn't mean the relationship between the two parties is set in aspic. Wakistan has a higher birth rate than the West, so after 40 years of stability, there are a lot more Wakistanis and a lot fewer Frenchmen. And Wakistan has immense oil reserves, and President Kotick has used the wealth of those oil reserves to fund radical schools and mosques in hitherto moderate parts of the Muslim world. And large numbers of Wakistanis have emigrated to the European Union, obliging opportunist politicians in marginal constituencies to pitch for their vote. And cheap air travel and the internet and bank machines that take every card on the planet and the freelancing of nuclear technology means that Wakistan's problems are no longer confined to Wakistan. For a few hundred bucks, they can be outside the Empire State Building within 8 or 9 hours. Stability is a surface illusion, like a frozen river. Underneath, the currents are moving, and to the casual observer, the ice looks equally stable, whether there's a foot of it or just 2 inches. There is no status quo in world affairs. Stability is a fancy term to dignify inertia and complacency as sophistication. If America and its allies defer to their foreign policy stability fetishists in the years ahead, and continue to place their faith in September 10th institutions like the UN, then in the long run, we'll all go the way of Tibet. There'll be nothing left to free. Containment is another overvalued commodity. It's an expensive dictator management program that, in the case of Iraq after the first Gulf War, required the United States Air Force and the RAF to bomb the country ineffectually every other week for 12 years, in return for which the Americans and British were blamed for UN sanctions and systematically starving to death 1 million Iraqi kids, or 2 million, according to which humanitarian agency you believe. Of course, the minute the war started and these genocidal sanctions came to an end, the left decided this UN containment had after all been a marvelous and desirable thing. Even what's regarded as a successful example of the strategy, the West's decision to contain the Warsaw Pact, was in practice no such thing, not for those on the receiving end. Aside from the fact that telling the other fellow he has to spend 50 years under communism is easy for you to say, the toll taken on those nations with every passing decade was grisly. On the hit parade of nations with the unhealthiest demographic profile, the top 5 are all former provinces of European communism: Latvia, Bulgaria, Slovenia, Russia, and Ukraine. Of the top 10, 9 are ex-commie. The exception is Spain. Of the top 20, 16 are. Communism was so loathed by its subjects, they gave up even breeding. And every year we allowed the Warsaw Pact to remain in place, we weakened further the viability of any post-communist societies that might emerge from the rubble. Stability and containment pose the opposite challenge in the Muslim world. Those countries are mostly in the upper reaches of the fertility hit parade. Whatever they loathe about their regimes, they don't loathe Islam. In many cases, the mosques provide the only political space in those lands. So they breed with gusto, and thus every year we remain committed to stability increases the Islamists' principal advantage. It strengthens the religion, the vehicle for their political project, and multiplies the raw material. So another decade or two of stability, and the world will be well on its way to a new Dark Ages. Now, as then, Europe has its do-nothing kings, les rois fainéants. though these days we call them European commissioners and chancellors and prime ministers. Now, as then, we have a great plague, the virus of Islamism, and the great migrations, the continent-wide version of white flight, already underway in Holland, as the beleaguered Dutch leave their native land for Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Now, as then, we must all bow before the Edict of Toleration, as laws and customs are rearranged to abase themselves before the gods of boundless multicultural tolerance. But the central fact of a new Dark Ages is this. It would be not a world in which the American superpower is succeeded by other powers, but a world with no dominant powers at all. Today, lots of experts crank out analyses positing China as the unstoppable hegemon of the 21st century. Yet the real threat is not the strengths of your enemies, but their weaknesses. China is a weak power. Its demographic and other structural defects are already hobbling its long-term ambitions. Russia is a weak power, a kind of greatest hits medley of all the planet's worst pathologies, disease-wise, nuke-wise, Islamist-wise. Europe is a weak power, a supposed greater France, remorselessly evolving month by month into greater Bosnia. Islam is a weak power, in the words of Dr. Mahathir bin Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, one of the least worst Muslim countries in the world. We produce practically nothing on our own. We can do almost nothing for ourselves. We cannot even manage our wealth. Yet in Iran, they're working full speed on nukes that will be able to hit every European city. North Korea is the weakest power of all, but on the 4th of July 2006, its dictator gamely got in the spirit and held a fireworks display. Impressive stuff, the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air. Though, as sometimes happens with your highest-priced firecracker, it was over sooner than expected. Kim Jong-il has no dong. Please, no giggling. It's not a side effect of that counterfeit Viagra that North Korea manufactures. Seriously. No dong is the name of his missile system. Dong is Korean for dong, and no is Korean for big swinging. And that's how Kim Jong-il sees himself on the freelance nuke scene. Anyway, on the glorious 4th, he decided to test the latest version of his no-dong. That's a test, in the sense that I test my new shotgun by firing it through your kitchen window and seeing if it penetrates to the living room. Kim's dong went up and came straight down again 40 seconds later. From the trajectory, experts calculated that it was headed to Hawaii. Instead, it fell in the Sea of Japan. And everyone had a big laugh. What a loser. What a bozo. Mr. Nukes R Us talks the talk, but he can't nuke the nuke. Ha ha, what a joke. But no, that's the point. That's why he's dangerous. He's not the United States, not the Soviet Union, not India. He's not even France. He's an incompetent, but he's got nuclear weapons. In 2006, he aimed for Hawaii and just about cleared his perimeter fence. Next time, he might aim for Hawaii and hit San Diego, or Oakland, or Calgary, or Presque Isle, Maine, or Beijing, Addis Ababa, Salzburg, or Dublin. He's a self-taught nuclear madman, and he hasn't quite gotten the hang of it. If you're on the New Jersey Turnpike, and there's a confused 93-year-old granny behind the wheel of a Toyota Corolla, that's mostly a problem for her. If she's in an 18-wheeler and coming across the median, that's a problem for you. North Korea has millions of starving people. It has one of the lowest GDPs per capita on the planet, lower than Ghana, lower than Zimbabwe, lower than Mongolia. But it's a nuclear power. The danger we face is not a Chinese superpower or an Islamist superpower. If there's a new boss, you learn the new rules and adjust as best you can. But the greater likelihood is of a world with no superpower at all. in which unipolar geopolitics gives way to nonpolar geopolitics, a world without order in which pipsqueak thug states who can't feed their own people globalize their psychoses. Take the subject of, say, decapitation, not something most of us had given a thought to since, the French Revolution. But there's a lot of it about. In 2006, a Taliban-like Islamist regime took control of Somalia, and in the course of their seizure of Mogadishu, captured troops from the warlord's side and beheaded them. The so-called emir of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, made beheading his signature act, cutting the throats of American hostage Nick Berg and British hostage Ken Bigley, and then releasing the footage as boffo snuff videos over the internet. And it's not just guerrillas and insurgents who are hot for decapitation. The Saudis, who are famously our friends, behead folks on a daily basis. In 2005, the kingdom beheaded 6 Somalis. What for? Murder? Rape? Homosexuality? No, it was worse than that. Auto theft. They'd been convicted and served 5-year sentences, but at the end thereof, the Saudi courts decided to upgrade their crime to a capital offense. Some 2/3 of those beheaded in Saudi Arabia are foreign nationals, which would be an unlikely criminal profile in any civilized state, and suggests that the justice system is driven by the Saudis' contempt for non-Saudis as much as anything else. The decapitators are getting closer. In an Ontario courtroom in 2006, it was alleged that a terror cell planned to storm the Canadian Parliament and behead the Prime Minister. On the face of it, that sounds ridiculous. As ridiculous as it must have seemed to Ken Bigley, a British contractor in Iraq with no illusions about the world. He'd spent most of his adult life grubbing around the seedier outposts of empire and thought he knew the way the native chappies did things. He never imagined the last sounds he'd ever hear were delirious cries of Allahu Akbar and the man behind him reaching for the blade to saw his head off. And why would an act of such awesome symbolic power remain confined to Islamists? A week or two after the revelation of that Toronto plot, there was a flurry of beheadings on America's southern border. The heads of 3 decapitated policemen were found in the Tijuana River. A 4th turned up in Acapulco a week later. It's wishful thinking to assume hip depravity won't migrate beyond the Islamist world. But no doubt Al Gore will carry on talking about global warming, and Nancy Pelosi about college tuition costs, and Hillary Clinton about prescription drug plans. As the world sinks into economic decline, arbitrary bombings and kidnappings, the occasional nuking, and a million small concessions to Muslim sensitivities that will nudge Western society ever further down a bleaker path. Writing about the collapse of nations such as Somalia, The Atlantic Monthly's Robert D. Kaplan referred to the citizens of such states as reprimitivized man. When lifelong Torontonians are hot for decapitation, when Yorkshiremen born and bred into fish and chips and cricket and lousy English pop music self-detonate on the London Tube, it would seem that the phenomenon of reprimitivized man is being successfully exported around the planet. In 1998, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times unveiled his Golden Arches theory that no 2 countries with a McDonald's franchise ever went to war. The ink was barely dry when America and NATO began bombing Serbia. So much for the civilizing effects of Big Macs in Belgrade. The Yugoslav meltdown of the 90s suggests the opposite of Friedman's thesis. In the 80s, the Federation was on its way to a comfortable, prosperous, post-communist future. Croatia was a popular holiday destination with Britons, Germans, and other wealthy Westerners. But, invited to choose between a booming economy and ancient hatreds, the people of Yugoslavia preferred to reduce their country to rubble. How many other bits of the map under pressure from predatory forces and with a leading power unable to lead, might opt for reprimitivization. A couple of weeks after September 11th, Edward Said, the New York-based American disparager and author of the best-selling Orientalism, made some remarks about the interconnectedness of the West and Islam. The professor deplored the tendency of commentators to separate cultures into what he called sealed-off entities, when in reality, Western civilization and the Muslim world are so intertwined that it was impossible to draw the line between them. Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, wasn't impressed by this notion. "The line seems pretty clear," he said. "Developing mass commercial aviation and soaring skyscrapers was the West's idea. Slashing the throats of stewardesses and flying the planes into the skyscrapers was radical Islam's idea." True, but as a form of cross-civilization intertwining, that's not to be disdained, at least from one party's point of view. Indeed, Mr.